This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond.
And you are listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. I'm Stephen Chudy.
And I'm Susan Chudy. A week ago, leaders from 50 countries, including President Obama, gathered in Seoul, Korea, for a summit on nuclear terrorism, ways of reducing the threat of terrorism given the amount of fissile material that resides around the globe. Tonight, we'll assess the results of that summit, including the implications for the environment. Our first guest will be Alexandra Toma, who is the executive director of the Connect USA Fund in Washington, D.C., a nonprofit working to reduce the possibility of nuclear terrorism and war.
And then we'll talk with Paul Walker, who's the international director of the Environment for Environmental Security and Sustainability, the program for Green Cross International and its U.S. national affiliate, Global Green USA. He's also interested in the nuclear terrorism issue and concerned with the destruction of chemical and biological weapons of mass destruction.
And we want to remind you that KZFR is in the midst of its spring pledge drive. We are doing well in achieving our goal of $50,000, but we still need your help. We hope that Ecotopia listeners will call in during the next hour and show their support for community radio. The number is 895-0131 and 895-0706. Please call.
Ecotopia is made possible in part by member contributions and by EcoCab, Chico's green alternative taxi service. EcoCab provides safe, reliable transportation 24 hours a day in a new fuel-efficient Toyota Prius. Protect the planet and get to where you need to be with EcoCab, the cab that cares. Call 591-3186. And we're supported by Chico Green Builders, providing healthy and sustainable homes for the greater Chico community for over 20 years. For new construction and remodeling, you can reach Robin Trenda by calling him at 342-8267 or email at chicogreenbuilders@att.net.
And we want to remind you that the opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers.
We'll take a short break, giving you an opportunity to call in your pledge, and then we'll be back to talk with Alexandra Toma of the Connect US Fund.
And those numbers are 895-0706, 895-0131.
Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. He fastened all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies.
You are listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 FM, exploring ecosystems, social, technological, environmental. Tonight's topic addresses nuclear materials and their effects on all our ecosystems, social, political, environmental. Our guest on the phone from Washington is Alex Toma. She's executive director of the Connect U.S. Fund, which has a mission of advancing a vision for responsible U.S. engagement. Alex is also founder and co-chair of the Fissile Materials Working Group, which is a non-governmental coalition of more than 60 U.S. and international organizations working to provide action-oriented policy solutions to keep the world safe from nuclear terrorism. Welcome, Alex.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
We thought in the first part of the discussion we'd focus on the nuclear summit held in Korea last week. More than 50 world leaders, including President Obama, hoped to agree on measures that would reduce the threat of nuclear terrorism. The press that we've read on the summit has been lukewarm at best, and we wondered if you could give us your take. What were the aims of the summit? What were the hopes for this gathering?
Yeah, no, that I think is a perfect characterization of the summit, lukewarm. My coalition, we said, you know, there were modest results. I think, you know, I'm a perpetual optimist, so I like to sort of see things, you know, both on the positive side, and then I like to say, oh, how could it have been done better? And so I think the positive side is it's really hard to get this kind of high-level attention on something that is so technical and that you can't, you know, see and feel. When we talk about ecology, you can, you know, when you talk about climate change, you can say, oh, I can do something about it. I can recycle. Well, what are people going to do about, you know, nuclear terrorism? And I'm happy to talk about that because I think there are things you can do, but on things that seem a little bit esoteric, it's hard to get attention. So I think that was a really positive outcome of the summit, is getting that many world leaders together and saying, you know what, this is really important. Here's what we're going to do about it. To address your lukewarm comment, I agree. I mean, I think the problem is the here's what we're going to do about it was modest. And it was, frankly, disappointing to some of us, you know, some of us nuclear security experts who've been working on this this topic.
Could you give us a little indication of what some of those modest achievements might have been? I know individual countries made some pledges. Other countries reiterated pledges, even if they haven't been coming through on those as one might hope.
Yeah, and that's exactly right, Steve. There were things like they checked in on things that were committed back in 2010 at the Washington Nuclear Security Summit. So there was kind of are we on pace? Are we checking? That's good. There were some countries that, for example, Italy, to eliminate its stocks of nuclear material, the stuff that makes bombs. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. The U.S. and other countries, Belgium, the Netherlands, agreed that they don't need to make medical isotopes, the stuff, you know, and when you're getting, you know, cancer scans at the hospital.
Right.
They don't need to use highly enriched uranium for that stuff. They can use low enriched uranium. So little steps like that. Definitely, they agreed to a lot of little things. I mean, I think what our coalition was trying to say is, look, like, that's all well and good, but what the problem is that this what we call this sort of regime around nuclear security, this system around nuclear security, it's a patchwork system. There are a lot of loopholes. And so we need sort of a bolder umbrella action, and that didn't come out of the summit.
One of the big concerns that we often hear about with fissile materials is that they may fall into the hands of terrorists. And could you explain to us what this risk is? Is that material readily available?
Definitely, Susan. I don't think, I mean, it's funny, people use the term loose nukes. I mean, these things aren't in downtown Chico. You know, you can't find them at your local, you know, Starbucks or whatever. But it's surprising that a semi-sophisticated rogue, you know, terrorist group could assemble, you know, not a perfect nuclear bomb, but they're not looking for perfect. They're looking to just get this thing out there. Mm-hmm. So time and time again, year and year again, U.S. intelligence officials, Interpol, who was actually at the summit, different intelligence around the world tells us that terrorist groups are continuing to try and get their hands on this stuff. In fact, back in the summer, we were talking just earlier about Romania and Romania's neighbors, Moldova. There was a nuclear smuggling ring that was busted up just this past summer.
Interesting.
And six of the guys were caught. There was a seventh guy that wasn't caught, and he was the one who had, you know, some of this nuclear material on him. His North African buyer, he wasn't caught. He's still out there. So we know there's a market. We know Al-Qaeda, you know, and other rogue elements have been trying to get the stuff around them. Another thing we know is that you only really need the size of a cantaloupe of nuclear material to make, to make one of these crude nuclear bombs. And there's enough, the last thing I'll say, which keeps me up at night, is that there's enough of this material sprinkled all over the world to make an additional 100,000 nuclear bombs.
My gosh.
With that bomb that you're describing, the cantaloupe size, is that the magic, we used to hear about 2.2 kilograms of material necessary to get a nuclear reaction?
Or you need 50 kilograms for
kilogram.
A crude, nuclear bomb. Yeah, 50 kilograms. But it's so dense that it's the size of a cantaloupe.
Okay.
It's not a lot. So you can basically sneak it around, you know, in a backpack or a, you know.
And you said it's sprinkled around the world. So are there hot spots, so to speak, for this material? Or are there, you know, who's got it?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. You know, anywhere that there is a research plant, anywhere that that we have nuclear weapons, obviously there are nine countries that we know that we that have nuclear weapons, and I would be most worried about places where there are a lot of nuclear weapons, like Russia and the U.S. Certainly, you know, the U.S. has, you know, pretty high security, although, you know, a couple of years ago we saw a U.S. Air Force plane leaving somewhere in the north of the United States, I can't remember where, and there were nuclear-armed missiles on board. Nobody knew they were on board. The pilot didn't know. The Air Force didn't know. Some a high-level Air Force general got fired for this. So even in the U.S. But the hotspots, I mean, Russia, you've got Pakistan. You know, Pakistan's neighborhood isn't that safe. So I'd be looking, you know, in Russia and Pakistan, where you've got elements in the country that are trying to get their hands on it, like Al-Qaeda, or you've got corruption that's just totally rampant.
So what would it take a terrorist to use this? I mean, obviously, this is something that would hurt everybody. I mean, not just the bad guys, but the good guys, too, however you interpret that. So is this a threat, you know, something that you can use to back people down, or is it something that people would actually use?
I mean, so here's the thing. I think you have to think about not just the immediate impact of a nuclear terrorist incident, for example, but the kind of chaos that it would create. It gives terrorists an upper hand. So, for example, let's use, I think somewhere relatively close by, let's use San Francisco to you guys. You know, big city, big port city. I mean, it's relatively close by. Not close by, but in your neighborhood.
Yeah, pretty close,
I was going to say Chico, but I don't think they'd be terrible. You know,
San Francisco is a good target. I don't want anybody to know that.
So San Francisco, huge port. It would disrupt, in addition to the tens of thousands of people that would die instantly, there's you know, hundreds of thousands that would get radiation poison. Then on top of that, there is the stoppage in global trade. There's the civil liberties aspect. Remember what happened after 9/11 with the Patriot Act. You know, I multiply that by God knows how much. You know, forget about the Bill of Rights. That thing's out the window. I don't know if we'd ever see it again, frankly. And then you've got then the last part, which is the scariest, is you don't know what else is coming up. So I remember on 9/11, you know, there was a rumor that Chicago was next. You know, there was a rumor that L.A. was next. Yeah. And so having that, like, psychological advantage, I think, would be really big.
Right, right.
And an equal concern seems to be nations that are engaged in developing nuclear weapons, in particular the threat coming from Iran, from North Korea. And I know that came up at the summit as well. Could you give us your take on what those discussions imply?
Yeah, I think, so you're definitely right, Stephen. Iran and North Korea, especially North Korea, because this thing took place in Seoul, so that's, God, I've been to the DMZ, and it's only like a 35-minute car ride north of Seoul, and there's 20 million people in Seoul. North Korea came up very obviously. The Fukushima disaster,
yes,
also came up.
Uh-huh.
So you've got the whole nuclear power, element of it. I think the good thing about Iran and North Korea not actually being at the summit is that I actually think it would have detracted from something that's related, for sure,
yes,
as you mentioned, but is kind of on a separate track. I mean, we're talking about, somewhere that doesn't have a fingerprint. I mean, Al-Qaeda, where would you strike back? How would you deal with that? What would that mean in terms of, the U.S. is very keen on retaliation. Where would you retaliate? How would you even go about responding to that? So I'm actually glad that North Korea and Iran weren't at the summit. Certainly you can't get around not talking about them, but I think it would have been a little bit of a distraction.
So the U.S. Connect Fund, getting back to where we are, in the Fissile Materials Working Group, as well as you used to work for Plowshares as well, have often recommended that the U.S. reduce its nuclear stockpiles, and they've been doing this. I mean, this has been pressure for a long time. And START calls for nuclear warheads from 2,200 to 1,600 by 2018. Is that correct?
And that's right.
Is that a reasonable, sensible number? Do we need to do more than that?
I think, yes, I think
all
we need
them
to do more than that. Personally, I think that you'll find studies, even recently, there are studies coming out almost every month that, yes, we can do more. We're not, and just to be clear for your listeners, we're not talking about unilateral reductions here. We're not talking about the U.S. saying, you know what, forget about it, these are out the door. We're talking about working with our allies abroad, like Russia, and you mentioned the New START agreement, which is the perfect example. A lot of people confuse, decreasing number of nuclear weapons to be just a unilateral thing.
Right.
It's not. It's an agreement, and it's people all around the world recognizing, you know what, these things are Cold War dinosaurs. We don't need them. They're not things that will keep us safe from 21st century threats, which is where we are right now, which is more about the rogue elements.
Right.
And so, definitely, I think the less weapons you have, the less chance you have that they're going to get into the wrong hand, the less chance you have that there's going to be some kind of accident, which has happened in the past, or some kind of theft, which, again, has also been attempted in the past.
Mm-hmm. Does START 2 address fissile materials generally, or is it limited just to nuclear weapons?
Just the weapons, Steve, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. I was going to add earlier, we're talking about Chico. Chico has been a nuclear-free zone since the early 1980s, when a progressive city council voted us as a nuclear-free zone, and the city enjoyed great ridicule at the hands of Paul Harvey, and I think even made the Johnny Carson show. The joke being, who cares? What's going to happen if we have nuclear materials in Chico? So Chico was an early progressive town, at least making a gesture in this direction.
And now there are so many more cities. I mean, even, close to me, there is, there's up in Maryland, a city that's, and now I'm totally blanking on the name, but they're also, a nuclear-free city. There's Mayors for Peace, that sort of people sign up for that. I think it's good to sort of express the community and tell people that there's something they can do about it. It's not just sitting at home and, worrying about these things, which is sort of what a lot of people do.
Could you tell us a little bit more about what the work of Connect US, what the Connect US Fund does, and what you do, and how you seek responsible U.S. global engagement? How do you go about doing that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I love talking about myself. No, I love getting them. It's so easy. I love getting the message out. And I think what sets the Connect US Fund apart from other more traditional both foundations and advocacy groups, we're both, actually, it's kind of a unique beast,
okay.
Is that we really invest in collaboration, and we really invest in bringing all the stakeholders to the table to collaborate on some joint policy initiatives. So who is everything that we need to bring on? We need to bring on the faith community, the business community, the national security community, everyone, all these different elements, all the different stakeholders on particular issues where we think the U.S. can really take a leadership role, that are complex, that are global issues that affect all of us, and where the U.S. can really lead. So we do that both through our own advocacy, our own programs and activities, and also through a small grants fund that we have that we can use to really realize these collaborative projects. So we work behind the scenes, very high level. We do media, you know, different pieces of media. A lot of what you'll see, you know, folks will look up the Connect US Fund. A lot of what you'll see is not on our website, because what we really try and do is bolster and amplify the work of our grantee partners. So that's what we're about. And I mean, all of the different ways in which we do this is through these various working groups that we run. And the Fissile Materials Working Group, which we're talking about here, nuclear mm-hmm. security, nuclear terrorism, it's the most visible out of our working groups. But we have other ones on human rights, focusing okay. on genocide, and mm-hmm. then another one on U.S. Climate leadership.
So do you do direct lobbying with the government, or do you primarily work on having people educate themselves so that they can influence lawmakers and policymakers?
It's the latter. We are okay. not a lobbying firm.
Okay,
yeah, we're
right.
Total public education, and then giving
okay.
giving people the tools they need to sort of do it themselves, to have their own voice directly with members of Congress
okay,
and the like.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And what's the power that you see of the collaborators, or I guess a more cynical way to put it, it would be who's paying attention when citizen groups, people of faith, activists make noise?
I think everybody. I mean, I think that's a really cool thing about the Connect US Fund, and my job in particular is, you know, of course, you know, let's just take you guys, you know, Chico, down citizens of Chico, of course you guys are going to be, against, most of you anyway, are going to be anti-nuclear weapons. But isn't it interesting when we pair you up with folks that are former military brass, you know, and they're also saying, hey, you know what? These guys have got it right. You know, mm-hmm. this is the right message, and here's why from a national security perspective. And then you have a rabbi in the room, and then you've got a priest in the room, then you've got a Buddhist monk in the room, and they're all saying, you know what, from a moral perspective, this is right as well. And so I think from the messages that we've gotten from policymakers, from members of Congress, it's a stronger message when you have different voices in the room.
Right, right. And then where does your work with the Fissile Materials Working Group fit in? To that effort.
Yeah, so so we run three working groups, three coalitions
okay.
on the three core issues on which we work. So there's a human rights one, there's one on climate, which is active
okay.
on specifically on trying to get some climate finance options on the table to try and combat climate change. And then the Fissile Materials Working Group is our sort of nuclear, you know, coalition. And the working group really just tries to, again, weave together different elements,
okay.
both here in the U.S. and also internationally.
Nice.
We'll post the links to your websites on our website, ecotopiakzfr.net.
Awesome.
But could you tell us just a little bit more about how people could get engaged in this movement, either through your organizations or other organizations that they should know about?
Definitely. Thanks for asking, actually. So the Fissile Materials Working Group, if you care about nuclear security, nuclear terrorism, it's pretty simple. FMWG, the letters of the acronym, fissilematerialsworkinggroup.org, FMWG.org. And there's actually a take action button. And so people can go on there. And I think there's about a dozen or a half a dozen direct things that people can do at home, from, you know, organizing a party to just talk about these issues. A big thing is lack of education, or writing their members of Congress. There's a link there that links you directly with your member of Congress.
Okay.
So the cool thing, too, is that because it's a coalition, you can go check out all the different, we have about 65 organizations involved. And so, you know, you can find the one that fits your style and, you know, that's close by to you and just join them directly. For Connect US Fund, if you want to find out more about the other issues we work on, you can sign up for our newsletter. It's free. There's a lot of cool stuff that comes out about the U.S. role in the world and how we can make that a little bit more positive by working together. So that's connectusfund.org.
Great. Our guest tonight has been Alex Toma. She is the executive director of the Connect US Fund and founder of the Fissile Materials Working Group. Thank you so much, Alex, for taking the time to talk with us.
Of course. Thank you both, Susan and Steve. I appreciate it. And happy to be back anytime you guys want to talk about these.
Great. We've got those other issues. Yes.
Right.
Great. Thank you.
Good luck with your work. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We're going to take a short break. We'll come back to talk with Paul Walker of Global Green USA, but we want to remind you to call in your pledge to KZFR Community Radio. We feel pretty pleased that we're able to bring you people, important national, international activists like Alex Toma and Paul Walker, whom we'll talk to next. But we need support. Our budget here at KZFR is very modest. We do things not quite on a shoestring, but very, very economically. But we do need support for the budget, including phone calls to Washington, D.C. We want to give thanks to some contributors who phoned in this hour, Jim Brobeck, who's been a fabulous guest host on this program, and Chris Nelson, who has likewise sat it in for us a couple times when we've been out of town. We thank them both for their wonderful support of Ecotopia.
You are listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico. Tonight we've been discussing the recent nuclear summit in Seoul and more broadly the dangers to our planet created by the accumulation of weapons of mass destruction. Our guest on the phone now is Paul Walker, who's the International Director of the Environmental Security and Sustainability Program for Green Cross International and its U.S. national affiliate, Global Green USA, located in Washington. Paul Walker is part of an international effort to facilitate and advocate the safe and sound demilitarization, nonproliferation, and remediation of nuclear, chemical, biological, and conventional weapons stockpiles. He's also a U.S. Army veteran from the Vietnam era. Welcome, Paul Walker.
Yeah, it's nice to be with you.
Thank you so much. In the first part of the program, we spoke with Alex Toma of the Connect USA Fund about the recent nuclear summit. And a couple of weeks ago, you wrote, "The Seoul Nuclear Security Summit must provide real progress in eliminating high-level nuclear materials and the major nuclear weapons states, including Russia and the United States, must lead the way." How well did we do? How well did our leaders in Russia and the United States do?
You know, first of all, Susan, the nuclear summit, I think, was was quite successful, and Alex Toma probably said the same thing. So, you know, I'd give high grades to the countries that really participated in the summit. There were 53 of them. The South Koreans, you know, put a very good program together, not only for governments, but also for NGOs and experts who were there. We participated in a big experts conference last week, about 10 days ago. And then there was also an industry, nuclear industry conference. When you talk about the United States and Russia, I mean, they are the largest holders of weapons-grade material, partly because they're the world's largest nuclear powers. Mm-hmm. And both of them have moved a long way forward in downblending high-enriched uranium to low-enriched uranium and you know, locking down their plutonium stockpiles as well. But they both still have a long way to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd probably give the United States maybe a B, I guess, if we were grading them, and okay. I'd give Russia probably a C.
Okay.
It's largely because they have a long way to go still with the hundreds of they have with the high enriched uranium and plutonium, let alone lower grade radioactive materials.
Right.
And also the other thing to mention on the United States in particular is they have not ratified the most recent two national conventions against nuclear terrorism. And that's partly because these treaties have been stalled in the U.S. Senate today with the, paralyzed politics in Washington,
right,
D.C.
Right.
So it's not really to blame the Obama administration or the prior Bush administration at all. It's just the paralysis in politics here in the Beltway in Washington.
What would be the contents of those anti-terrorism treaties or non-terrorism treaties?
Yeah, there are two treaties, and these are the ones that have really been pointed out in the final communique from the Nuclear Security Summit as extremely important. One is called the International Convention for the Suppression of Acts of Nuclear Terrorism. The nickname of that is ICSANT, or ICSANT. And that treaty, which was done in 2005, criminalizes any sort of acts of nuclear terrorism, theft, diversion, smuggling of weapons-grade nuclear material. And there are 79 states parties, so we have less than, the world as a member of it today. And there are another 115 signatories, in other words, states who've signed but not ratified yet. And included in that category, signed but not ratified, is Iran, North Korea, Pakistan, Vietnam, and the United States, and also countries like Argentina, Australia, Canada, Israel, Norway, and Sweden. So there's a long way to go before that really enters into force. And then the second one is called the Convention on the Physical Protection of Nuclear Material. And that's an older treaty done in 1980. It's got a much larger, it's got twice the number, it's probably 145. And unfortunately, the United States signed and ratified that treaty, but there's an amendment, an upgrade to it, that was done in 2005, and the United States has not yet ratified that amendment. And that's really to, provide much higher-grade physical protection to all nuclear materials in each country, and also have the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, oversee those upgrades. So the United States is still a bit behind, I think. But, that's not to be overly critical, I think. The U.S., amongst all countries, has spent more money than most of them combined, on trying to, secure nuclear weapons, warheads, particularly in the former Soviet Union. They've helped Kazakhstan and Belarus and the Ukraine give up their nuclear weapons. They've also helped secure and destroy major strategic launch systems. So these were not particularly subjects of the Nuclear Security Summit, but it's all really interrelated in the nuclear weapons and fissile material issue.
We were interested, your title, we want to get clear on Green Cross International and Global Green, the international and the U.S. affiliates, but your title is Director of Security and Sustainability, and we were interested in the linking of those two terms. Wondered if you could tell us about your organizations and the link between what you see between security and sustainability.
Sure, be happy to do that. You know, Green Cross International was really a creation of the lost Rio de Janeiro Earth Summit in 1992. So when a lot of the world's environmentalists and concerned citizens came together 20 years ago, they really advocated that we have a new, more vocal advocate for saving the Earth, really, and how human beings treat the Earth. And the person who was really put forth to be the head of that was Mikhail Gorbachev, who had obviously just lost his job in the Soviet Union and was actually looking for interesting things to do. And so Gorbachev created, in 1993, Green Cross International, which is headquartered in Geneva, Switzerland. With the creation of Green Cross, what some people call the Environmental Red Cross, we created five national affiliates, the United States being one. The other countries were Japan, Russia, Switzerland, and the Netherlands, and the United States. And all of those affiliates are called Green Cross X, Y, or Z. Green Cross Germany, okay. Green Cross Argentina, Green Cross Australia. Today we have somewhere between 30 to 35 national affiliates around the world. And the focus of all of those affiliates is really what Gorbachev set forth in 1993, and that was to, number one, address the policies of the Cold War in weapons of mass destruction through nonproliferation policies, arms control, disarmament, abolition. And secondly, to address climate change in various ways. And what we do in the United States primarily is through what we call the built environment. So we address climate change through promoting a green building, green schools, you know, limits to carbon emissions. And then thirdly, to protect natural resources. And we do a lot of work globally on everything from tree planting to provision of potable water and protection of water and other natural resources. So the work that Green Cross and Global Green does is really a combination of environmentalism and also arms control, disarmament, and conflict resolution and peaceful means of conflict resolution. It's a good group. I've been with Global Green for about 16 years now. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, I was actually working on the Armed Services Committee in the House of Representatives. I oversaw the U.S. military budget. And what interested me in Gorbachev's initiatives was one of the toughest things we had to do right after the end of the Cold War in the early 1990s was look at all the base, you know, realignment and closure work, the over 300 or 400 major military bases being closed in the United States and abroad,
right,
and all the widespread pollution that existed. So I felt Gorbachev really brought together the fact to be a sustainable, you know, healthy, safe, and peaceful world. We really have to combine security and sustainability. You can, you know, for example, you could resolve climate change and limit, I suppose, global warming, but unless you did all the cleanup, the legacies left over from our military-industrial, you know, crises of and wars of the last century, we're really not going to be a sustainable world. It was all of the toxic pollution, including nuclear weapons, radioactive materials, Fukushima-like disasters, you know, radioactive pollution that's been left at uranium mines, chemicals that have been left behind in chemical weapons, biological diseases that have been left behind due to the biological weapons programs, and also, you know, less dramatic toxic waste like pesticides and and other heavy metals. Unless you clean all that up, you're really not going to be a sustainable community. So that's in many ways the connection between security and sustainability.
So did the Armed Services Committee have these kinds of concerns about the toxins? Was that a part of the way that the committee thought about security? Was that a part of the way they thought about it?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, Susan. Back in the early 90s, when we were dealing with this, you know, the Berlin Wall fell in 89, mm-hmm. and really the Soviet Union broke up in 90 and 91, mm-hmm. and the Cold War ended somewhere around that 2 or 3 or 4 year period.
Right.
And that's when both the Soviet Union, the Warsaw Pact, and the United States all went through major base closure. And
right.
we, at the time, I think there was not a great deal that had been given to really the enormous pollution that exists across the land on not only closing military bases, but on existing military bases and on firing ranges and the like. So we pressed the case in the early to mid-90s from the Armed Services Committee, but the environmental community did too. And
okay.
I know certainly Gorbachev and Green Cross started the whole campaign to sort of clean up the world as best we could.
Right.
And part of the challenge is a lot of this pollution exists in the developing world. You know, and we see this in instances every single day, whether it's, you know, the recycling of ships in the Indian coast,
mm.
you know, in which you have really heavy metals and high toxic waste, whether it's the dumping of computers and electronics everywhere around the world, or things we're very concerned with are really old firing ranges like Vieques, you know, the island off of Puerto Rico, or Ko'olawe, the island off in Hawaii that's been used as a firing range.
Uh-huh.
So you wind up having
right.
you wind up having unexploded ordnance. You know, we're still finding unexploded ordnance, you know, weapons that are live and still very dangerous all over the world, particularly in Europe, but also not simply on the 20th century fields. We're finding them in all the training ranges. You know, I think what most people don't realize is the United States is an example of one of the very militarized countries in the world. It has over 100 tons of obsolete weapons they have to destroy every year.
Mm-hmm.
And of the weapons that are actually used, most of those are actually fired on training ranges in the United States or in, you know, mm-hmm. off the coasts of Hawaii or east or west coasts of the U.S., and off the coast of Allied Navy. And you wind up having to eventually clean up all that.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem has been that the militaries around the world, not just the U.S., but, you know, our NATO allies and certainly China and Russia and the former Soviet Union have not done the old adage, you know, clean as you go.
Right,
and so,
right.
And so we end up having enormous amounts of pollution, very dangerous issues. I mean, the case around Vieques off Puerto Rico, for example, which was a naval bombing range for decades, there's, you know, 4 or 5 times the cancer rates on Vieques today.
Oh, my gosh.
Than there is right next door in Puerto Rico.
Right.
And so we're trying to press the case that we need to look at that more closely to see, you know, really what's causing that. Is it potentially the unexploded ordnance and leftover toxic pollutants from the decades of bombing the coastline of Vieques that's getting into the fish and the wildlife and the
right.
food chain for the people there or what? So there are many, many cases like that that we deal with. We've been very involved in chemical weapons demilitarization, for example, that very few people are aware
right.
of. But, you know, that's a whole class of weapons of mass destruction that is probably the most likely to be used by terrorists. And the fact that the United States, you know, has declared 31,500 tons of nerve agent and mustard and lewisite at 9 stockpiles around the
my
United
gosh.
States. Most people don't know that, but, you know, to the credit of the United States, you know, they've gone forward and signed the Chemical Weapons Convention in 1993 and 4 and ratified it in 1997, which we worked on in Washington here. And they've now destroyed 90% of those stockpiles, which is a big step forward. And the Russians have declared 40,000 tons at 7 stockpiles, too. And we're continuing to work with the Russian government and the Russian citizens and environmentalists and public health regulators and the like, to try to safely get rid of their weapons as well.
That's you said you try to press the case. You press the case with, and one of my questions was, who are you pressing the case with? Is it governments? Is it NGOs? Is it militaries? Who are you trying to influence? All of the above.
Yeah, and what might our role be? Because these are enormously, you know, expensive.
Expensive, that was the other thing.
Technical challenge.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, in our role in trying to promote the safe and secure lockdown of weapons of mass destruction and high-grade fissile materials, in this case with the Nuclear Security Summit, but also with the chemical and biological weapons, we actually work with all, we call all stakeholders. We work at the very highest level, the international level, with the arms control and verification regimes, like the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons in The Hague, or the IAEA in Vienna, or the Biological Weapons Convention in Geneva, Switzerland. We also work at the national levels. We worked a lot with the U.S. government and the U.S. military and the Russian government and the Russian military. And then we feel very strongly, as environmentalists and arms controllers, that all of these stockpiles sit in some community someplace. So the people bearing the worst burden on either fissile materials, nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, even conventional weapons, are really the local citizens and the states where they reside. And so we work a lot with regions, state mm-hmm. governments, and local citizens to try to empower and make these processes, you know, which during the war were very top secret and highly sensitive, are now much more public. And we try to make them as public as possible. And our role has really been to advocate for the safe and sound destruction and timely destruction, so to commit the funds in Congress to move forward on these programs and also do it in a safe and sound way. Sometimes the militaries are very reluctant to expend the money that really needs to be committed to these projects to do it in the right way. So, you know, they may want to, for example, blow up a catch of conventional weapons they find in the middle of a field somewhere. And we'll say, no, what you should do is collect those weapons as long as you can do it safely without hurting anybody, and then blow up those weapons or burn them up, neutralize them in some way in controlled, closed mechanisms, which they can do, which takes a little more time and maybe more expensive, but in fact, in the long run, is much safer and sounder.
It also seems very difficult to get encourage the military to clean up from the past, but also prepare for the future. We recently watched on late night TV two classic films. First, Dr. Strangelove with Peter Sellers, and then right. War Games. And in both cases, you've got arrogant military and political people bumbling. They nearly bring the world to an end. We're obviously, or maybe not, past the era of mutually assured destruction through intercontinental ballistic missiles. But what level of security is essential to our country and other countries at this point, even as we talk about disarming, START II, and so forth?
Well, I think we've obviously always been concerned about both security and safety, and those two, in my mind, are very much interlinked. When we talk about the Nuclear Security Summit, they're really talking about the security on, you know, weapons-grade fissile materials. But you can look right across the board about the need to secure all weapon systems, not just weapons-grade radioactive materials, but in fact conventional weapons, obviously nuclear weapons, and biological diseases and all the like. You know, I think all of us, the United States, the Soviets, our NATO and East European allies in the past, were somewhat behind the curve on the necessary levels of security. And also behind the curve on the necessary levels of safety for the workers and the local communities as well. So one of the, you know, very big issues at the Nuclear Security Summit, both in Washington in 2010, but also in Seoul last week, mm-hmm. was really to have a heightened awareness of the need for very high levels of security and safety. And the challenges that maybe your prior guest spoke about too is that all of this still remains quite voluntary.
Right.
And so there's no really imposed level of safety and security
right.
At any of these sites at all. What helped a bit, ironically, was 9-1-1. When the terrorist attacks happened in September 2001, all of a sudden, for example, the chemical weapons stockpile sites that we've worked with since 1995, which had relatively lax security on them, all of a sudden there became heightened security. You know, the U.S. Army said, my God, you know, terrorists could actually mm-hmm. think of attacking these stockpiles or sneaking in and stealing some
right.
of the weapon systems. And we had, you know, for example, open-air stockpiles sitting on the Chesapeake Bay. You know,
wow.
a terrorist literally
wow.
could have taken a rowboat and filled a gallon jug worth of mustard agent and rowed away. And, you know, we've had cases in the past. I remember in the 1980s, even when we had anti-nuclear activists who broke into nuclear weapons bases and actually hammered on, B-52 bombers and cruise missiles, not to steal or detonate the weapons, but to, in fact, you know, indicate that we need to get rid of these things. And so the security, I think, and safe workers has been wanting tremendously for years. And now I think after 9/11, in the last decade, it's been much better. Mm-hmm. But we still worry, you know, there's over 2,100 tons, for example, of high-grade nuclear weapons material around the world in 100-odd countries. And those could potentially make, you know, 100,000 nuclear bombs. Mm-hmm. And the security in many of those countries, particularly countries like Pakistan and maybe some others with high-enriched uranium at research reactors, is very, very lax. Even in our own country today, university reactors with high-enriched uranium mm-hmm. have almost no security on them at all. So that's what we worry all the time. We try to advocate and raise awareness and push the militaries to address these, but also push the parliaments and the congresses to fund the programs to get the work done.
Amazing work. Amazing. Our guest has been Paul Walker. He is the Director of Security and Sustainability for Green Cross International. You can learn more about their work at www.globalgreen.org, where they have a number of excellent articles, blogs on the kinds of issues we discuss on this program. And you can also check out gcint.org and learn more about the work of Green Cross International. We appreciate your being with us and your enormous expertise and deep knowledge on this subject. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul.
Glad to be with you both, Stephen. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Good night. Yeah.
So I told him that he'd better shut his mouth and do his job like a man. And he answered, "Listen, Father, I will never kill another. He thinks he's better than his brother that died. What the hell does he think he's doing to his father who brought him up right? Take your place on the great Mandela as it moves through your brief moment of time, win or lose."
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, social, environmental, and technological. Tonight's program focused on nuclear security issues and weapons of mass destruction.
As listeners know, we cover a wide range of issues on this program. In fact, this is our 183rd Ecotopia program. We've touched on issues ranging from GMOs to ocean conservation,
from the voyage of the plasticky to soil and worms,
from environmental film festivals to sustainable optimism.
And next week, our guest on the program will be none other than Joel Salatin, internationally renowned farmer, lecturer, sustainability advocate, and who will be speaking in Chico on April 16th.
We like to brag on KZFR Radio. Where else in the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond can you get the kind of range of interviews done in depth on so many topics, including programs like The Point Is, The Peace and Justice Hour, World Cultures, and so forth? Only on Community Radio KZFR. Please call in now with your pledge. And we want to thank Charles Withune, who just called in this hour.
Please call. You still have a few minutes during Ecotopia, 895-0706, 1-800-895-0131 and support community radio.
The underwriters for this hour of Ecotopia have been Ed's Printing. Ed's Printing, which offers envelopes, business cards, newsletters, flyers, and carbonless forms. A variety of recycled paper is available. Ed's Printing is located at 550 Cherry Street in Chico. The telephone number is 891-4625. And we've been supported by Alternative Energy Systems, a locally owned and operated partnership providing energy for life. Their information is available on the web at www.solarenergyforlife.com. Alternative Energy Systems offers energy solutions for residential, commercial, and agricultural needs. They can be reached by calling 345-6980.
Please call 895-0706, 895-0131, and support your community radio station. Coming up at 7 this evening is the storyteller with your anthropological guide, Adrian Scott, who I believe has a guest with her tonight, and she'll bring you stories, legends, and music from long ago and modern-day cultures.
And then at 7:30, it's All Mixed Up, 2.5 hours of rock and pop from the edges of mainstream and contemporary music, blurring the boundaries of most commercial radio. Stay tuned and enjoy a listening world that is all mixed up. Thanks for listening to Ecotopia. I'm Stephen Chudy.
And I'm Susan Chudy. Contact us at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com or visit our website, ecotopiakzfr.net. And you can also follow us on Facebook and receive advance notice of upcoming shows. Tune in next week for Joel Salatin.
Say